We are back with Greg Paul, and I want to thank Greg for being on the show. Do you hear me all right, Greg?
A little better.
Okay. So Greg has written quite a few books. I think 5 books I saw on your website, gregpaul.com. That's GREGPAHL.com. And you've been writing them over the last several years, really. You've gotten a lot of writing done in the last several years.
Yes, I guess I've been pretty busy.
Yeah. Well, I've read your most recent book, The Citizen-Powered Energy Handbook, Community Solutions to a Global Crisis. And what I found really interesting about the book was that you go a lot into the details of various renewable energy options, but your real focus is on how to make renewable energy projects sort of community-based and cooperative. Why do you focus at that level?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, I think it's mostly because the challenges that we're going to be facing in the years ahead related to peak oil and just energy in general, to say nothing of climate change, are so substantial that it's going to take a cooperative effort at all levels, both local, state, and federal, in order to make the kind of quantum leap or transition away from our current dependence on fossil fuels to reliance on a much broader array of different renewable strategies.
Mm-hmm. And so I've known that the renewable energy industry has been focused on very large-scale wind projects, for example, or around here you have installers putting like photovoltaics or solar hot water on people's homes. So you're saying that we need to really not just do those, but also focus on some of these intermediate scales, perhaps. So it takes all scales, in a sense.
Yes. In fact, at the present time, I think that there, at least in North America, there's quite a gap between the small, you know, backyard installation of whatever strategy versus the large, you know, commercial scale projects. So there's a huge opportunity there for local groups and communities to get involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the terms being used for this is community supported energy. Can you explain what that is and what sort of projects might be done on in a sort of the rubric of community supported energy?
Sure, community supported energy. Which is also sometimes referred to as community-based energy development, CBED. But whatever you call it, these types of projects are, I think, most similar to what people would refer to as community-supported agriculture, or mm-hmm. CSA. We have a lot of examples of that in various parts of the country. Certainly here in Vermont, where I live, we have a lot of very active CSA types of farmers market-related activities. The main difference, however, is that instead of investing in food with community-supported energy projects, local residents invest in these energy projects that provide greater energy security along with a cleaner environment and a wide variety of other benefits. Mm-hmm. CSE can be applied to virtually any type of local renewable energy projects, such as wind, solar thermal or photovoltaic systems, perhaps biogas digesters for electricity, a variety of biofuels production facilities, either ethanol or biodiesel, perhaps geothermal or geoelectric projects in the parts of the country that have those resources, and then, of course, small-scale hydroelectric as well.
Mm-hmm. So it really depends. Almost anything can be done with this. It just depends on where you live that makes renewable energy, which renewable energy technology is most viable is very local specific. That's right.
Yeah, that's true. And not only that, but when groups or communities are thinking of getting involved in something like this, the first thing they need to look at is what their local renewable energy resources are.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it doesn't make any sense to try to put up a community wind farm if you don't have a good wind resource.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but on the other hand, if you're sitting next to a really great hydroelectric resource, then that might be one of the first projects you might want to look into.
So let's look at some of the reasons why people might want to band together to do this. What is it that this provides that individuals can't do, and what does this provide that, say, large corporations with a bunch of capital that can do really large projects? Why is this middle ground important?
Well, I think the primary advantages of call this CSE, mm-hmm. Community Supported Energy, there are quite a few. They create new jobs and business opportunities for local communities.
Mm-hmm.
They generally expand the tax base. They can generate new income. They can retain more money in the local economy, and there are a number of studies that tend to indicate that you could keep as much as 3 or 4 times the amount of money circulating in the local economy versus a project that's owned by, say, an out-of-state corporate entity.
Right. So, go ahead. You want to go more?
Yeah, and then one more really, really important advantage of these strategies is that they tend to get, local residents involved directly in the project.
Hmm.
And that tends to eliminate a lot of the potential not in my backyard sort of reaction.
Yeah, but possibly also waste and inefficiency. I think that if you're investing in energy, you learn about energy, and you probably then realize how precious it is. I feel that way with food. As I started growing food, I really didn't want to waste food because I know what went into
mm-hmm.
every aspect of from the seed to the plate.
That's right.
To the compost pile.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, with energy perhaps as well. Maybe we just take it for granted. You flip the switch and it arrives. But
mm-hmm.
if you have to make something happen like that. That's very, really interesting. One of the things that I think about is that it's hard to fund these kind of things potentially. So what kind of strategies are used to go about getting these projects, maybe the research that happens to figure out what's the appropriate technology, and then pulling people together and then getting funding streams into it, and then letting people get a return on their funding in a sense that's fair.
Yeah. Because in the absence of a coherent national energy policy.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one way fits all sort of strategy that works for everybody, and so you have to start thinking rather flexibly and keep your mind open to any number of different approaches. Some might be really good here in Vermont; they might not work there, California, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So the most common strategies would probably be, and I'm talking about technical ownership models,
mm-hmm.
might be a legal liability corporation,
okay.
limited liability corporation, LLC.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It could be a cooperative, and there are a number of good examples of those.
Mm-hmm.
It might be something as basic as a school district,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe a municipal utility,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps other municipal entity of some sort. There could be a combination of some of these possible strategies, and there might be some others as well that would be peculiar to a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the key here is to think collaboratively, cooperatively as a community, but be open to a variety of different legal paths in order to make it happen.
Right, right. So earlier, just previously, you were talking about the importance of local ownership. I know that, for example, here in Willits,
mm-hmm.
there was a project going forward to put photovoltaic system at the water treatment plant to pump the water out of the reservoir through the treatment center, and it's a lot of capital that has to go into this.
Yep.
And the city ended up basically getting, I think, private capital, where the city doesn't now own the system. It's essentially a lease arrangement, and the city locks in its rate for a long, long time. And I saw that there's a school district in our local, a nearby county here, where the whole district is going to basically have its roof space available,
mm-hmm.
and private venture capital is going to go in and install these solar panels, and It sounds really good, but you were arguing for local ownership of these things. Mm-hmm. Is this what the examples I'm talking about, is that local ownership? Or?
Well, I guess it would depend a little bit on who the local owners were.
Mm-hmm. Where the capital's coming from.
Right. Local ownership is the key ingredient that transforms what would otherwise just be, you know, another corporate energy project into an engine for local economic development. But local ownership even would have to be viewed as a somewhat flexible concept.
Okay.
It could be a local school district decides to do this.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Because that's ultimately going to save taxpayers money, mm-hmm. and it's going to provide a certain amount of energy security in terms of pricing.
Mm-hmm.
If your local investors, even if it's a private, private company of some sort, is composed of a relatively large number of local residents, then that's local ownership.
Okay.
If it's just one or two people, have a lot of money, well, that's okay. It is keeping the money, at least in the local area.
Mm-hmm. What if it's a Wall Street investment fund of some kind that's venturing into renewable energy?
Well, any time you start with outside investors,
mm-hmm.
the income from the project gets siphoned out of the local economy, and that really eliminates one of the key advantages of the whole local ownership strategy.
So this would be like the multiplier effect gets removed, et cetera?
Yes.
So explain how that works in terms of taxes and...
Mm-hmm. Well, this multiplier effect is valid for any number of local economic activities.
Right.
Energy, sure. Agriculture, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other models that also have the same types of benefits. The people who are hired by locally based projects tend, for the most part, to be local.
Mm-hmm.
And so the workers who construct the projects tend to spend their money in the local economy. The
mm-hmm.
people who are hired to maintain the projects
mm-hmm.
can stay in the local community, and they tend to spend their money there, and they don't have to commute somewhere else to go to work, so you're solving several problems at one time. And just in general, all of the activity, because it's locally planned, locally sited, locally based, locally staffed, just tends to keep much more money flowing within the community. And then your local owners, mm-hmm. whoever they may be, whether it's a cooperative or a group of individuals or whatever, they're receiving the income for this project as well, from the project, whatever it is, whether it's an electrical generating facility or, mm-hmm. or producing biofuels or whatever. And they tend to keep circulating their money within the local community as well, because that's where they live.
Right.
Again, if the owners are somewhere else, the profits from the company are being siphoned out of your local economy.
Yeah, it even gets as mundane as sponsoring a Little League team or, being a member of the local Rotary Club and putting in money for community projects through those sort of things. I mean, apparently the stats I've seen is that local businesses tend to supply, up to several times more in community-based, what you would call, supporting the civic society, the what might be called charitable, or just where government doesn't quite cover things, where the private business doesn't cover things, that those gaps are filled in by, I think, local citizens knowing that this needs to happen, and they pitch in.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's really important to stress that community-supported energy projects, or any local community project like this, really boosts the local economic development. And when you start talking in terms of local economic development, it's amazing about how quickly you can get support from the community and from the business community and from all parts of the political spectrum. It doesn't matter. If you're talking about local economic development, almost everybody agrees on that.
Mm.
And it strengthens and revitalizes the local business community, and it just creates more jobs that meet local needs. It's just it's a real exciting sort of thing that everybody can get on board with.
Yeah. Something that struck me is you mentioned energy security in the context of all this.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is come on the public radar screen more. Can you tell us a little more about how local renewable energy increases our energy security?
Okay. It provides, first of all, more stable energy prices. Hmm. And I think that's really important these days. I mean, I don't know about your part of the country, but we've had quite a few rather dramatic and ongoing price increases for all types of energy.
Yes.
Here in New England for a number of years. And, I mean, even just gasoline prices have hit all-time records at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You also provide greater energy self-reliance, which I think is a really important factor that a lot of people haven't paid much attention to until fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
In an energy-constrained future, those communities that have had the foresight to plan ahead and start providing more of their local energy from local resources are going to be in a much stronger position than those that didn't.
Yeah.
These projects literally empower communities to take not only more responsibility for their own energy needs, but it also offers a lot of real benefits.
What's interesting to me is that if I try to talk about energy security, people can relate to it in terms of, say, a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they can even relate to it in terms of a political crisis, a mm-hmm. war that gets out of hand. The Persian mm-hmm. Gulf goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Very few seem to think about it in terms of just geological depletion. Have you had any success or experience talking to people about different ways of thinking about security, sort of their short-term emergency crisis type security where, maybe just stockpile some stuff mm-hmm. and have a buffer versus the long-term kind of decline of our resource base?
Right, right. And I think perhaps you may be referring to the depletion of oil,
mm-hmm.
in
natural gas and coal.
Yeah.
Coal apparently is going to peak pretty soon, also.
Yeah. This is a subject which is finally arriving on the radar screen. The subject of peak oil and other resources that are also finite
mm-hmm.
has been talked about for decades, of course, but most people just have not been paying much attention because conventional energy, and particularly petroleum, has been so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the ongoing rise in energy prices, in particular the price of oil, is beginning to make people pay attention. And so I feel that the awareness of the problem or the potential problem is certainly much greater than it was even just a year ago.
Yeah,
I've seen a marked difference here, at least in New England, and I understand that there are quite a few other groups and cities and towns around the country that are beginning to pay attention to this.
Yeah.
So I think that we're beginning to head in the right direction, but there's still a lot of people out there who just don't get it.
Yeah. What also that I find interesting is the way that issues are compartmentalized often. So you may say, we have a water crisis. We need more water. And then the idea is, we'll pump it. And we'll pump it out of an aquifer or we'll build a new large infrastructure that requires maintenance and or transportation infrastructure. We've got bottlenecks in the roads, so we need to build more roads. We need to make them out of asphalt and concrete. And the assumption in almost all of these issues is that energy will be cheap and available forever, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Has the interrelationships among these issues percolated in policy that you've seen where you're living yet?
It's beginning to. It's mm-hmm. still fairly early on. I mean, the subject of peak oil in particular wasn't even on the national radar screen at all just a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that recently, at least, I've occasionally listen to reports of the Vermont legislature's activities, which incidentally spent the first several weeks of its session this year talking about global warming, which is pretty amazing. And not only that, but just studying it and learning about the implications of it and then crafting legislation to respond. So there certainly has been some progress here. And I turned on the radio a number of times and listened to members of the legislature and other people in state government actually talking about peak oil.
Wow.
Which was really a dramatic change.
Yeah, apparently, you know, you've got the governor and lieutenant governor of New York are mm-hmm. pretty aware of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word is spreading and it's beginning to percolate throughout the society. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the recent General Accountability Office report on peak oil, which was just released a few weeks ago, I think, has pretty much eliminated any lingering doubts about the reality of that issue, and I think has, again, brought this issue front and center for more and more people. So I'm encouraged. There certainly has been progress.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been talking a lot on this show about these challenges, mentioning peak oil and global climate change, sort of the economic disruption. These are some of the things that this show, The Reality Report, often goes over. And I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to KZYX in Philo, KZYZ Willits in Ukiah. This is The Reality Report. I'm your host, Jason Bradford. And our guest today is Greg Paul. He's a prolific author of 5 books on sustainable living and renewable energy, and we are today discussing the subject of his most recent book, The Citizen-Powered Energy Handbook, Community Solutions to a Global Crisis. We'll be opening the phones up in about 5 or 10 minutes. 456-9991 is a studio phone. But I just want to say that we have all these challenges ahead, and I know personally that it really helps me to find my place in this situation as someone who's proactively looking for solutions, finding new opportunities, changing basically how my expectations and my work in the world. So, what do you find in your life? What are you doing, and what opportunities do you see for others?
Well, I think you need to start where you are in order to get to where you'd like to be. And so there's a broad range of activities that almost anyone could undertake, and it starts at home, of course, to try to tighten up your own act as much as possible, looking at the efficiency of your home, looking at the efficiency of your appliances, perhaps your vehicle. If your vehicle is nearing the end of its career, it might be time to replace it with a higher efficiency hybrid of some sort, electric hybrid. Lots of things like that. And then, but again, to go back to what I said earlier, that the challenges are so great that mm-hmm. although all of that is important, and I strongly recommend it, we have to start thinking bigger than that and going to a more cooperative or collaborative approach, which
yeah.
can certainly be a community approach. And that's really what most of my book is about.
It is, yeah.
Beyond the obvious technical aspects of the renewable strategies that are described,
mm-hmm.
it's all about community.
Yeah.
Why
don't we talk more about that? What are the examples of communities that have come together? How are some places actually implementing maybe CS, community supported energy projects,
mm-hmm.
or other kind of things like that?
Right. Well, I guess here in Vermont, I have the most familiarity with what's going on where I live, and I will say that within the last year or two, especially within the last year, there has been a groundswell of interest at the community level in all of these issues.
Mm.
It's not just energy, it includes food as well, because
yeah.
food and energy are two of the probably most important
yes.
basics, necessities of life. And there has been a real outpouring of interest in all of this. We now have about, I think it's 8 or maybe 9 local community groups scattered around the state
mm-hmm.
that are all more or less working on the same general response to these challenges that we're going to be facing in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a group called VPON, the Vermont Peak Oil Network, mm-hmm. which is a sort of a clearinghouse for all of these groups. It's web-based, that has done a really good job of connecting these groups to each other, because mm-hmm. a lot of them really weren't aware of each other's existence until fairly recently. So that's been really empowering for these groups to find out what other people are doing and then to be able to share our experiences, successes, and failures.
Yeah.
And that has been really powerful.
Are they hooked into the relocalization network of
yes.
Post Carbon Institute?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been very, very helpful. But I think beyond the economic and financial benefits of all of this, we're really talking about rebuilding community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, communities everywhere have been, I think, decimated by this whole globalization pattern that has evolved in the past few decades.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an opportunity for people to come together, you know, within their local communities to start to think about dealing with these issues in proactive and productive ways that will help these local communities. So, and we're going to be facing a lot of these challenges in the years ahead. And those communities, again, who gain experience in cooperating on some of these issues now,
yeah.
like local energy or local food, whatever it may be, are going to be, again, better positioned because of the simple experience of going through these exercises.
Yeah, working together on something.
Working together to do a community energy project of some sort, working together to strengthen and expand their local community-supported agriculture projects, mm-hmm. farmers markets, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience of working together is going to be invaluable, in my opinion, in the years ahead. And if for no other reason than to gain that experience,
yeah.
it makes sense to pursue some of these projects now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got the time and the money and the wherewithal to do something about it.
Yeah, it's interesting how because of global economic integration, then local small businesses may have their distributors or suppliers, their services provided by companies anywhere in the world almost.
Mm-hmm.
And that has led to even, you know, a lot of linkages within the business community within towns and cities aren't like they used to be. And the same thing's probably true then of consumers. If consumers can order something over the web, pay with their credit card, don't need to have any FaceTime with anybody,
mm-hmm.
then there we go. There's another sort of linkage that is broken. And so a lot of what I see is the opportunity to reestablish these social relationships again.
Mm-hmm. There's a whole sector of our economy that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
It's that kind of middle sector.
Mm-hmm.
the support for what used to be, you know, local businesses all over the country has essentially vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the Walmartization of the economy,
yeah.
you've got this huge gap that used to support all of these local activities that just isn't there anymore, and it's been replaced by a system that relies on a huge and very energy intensive supply chain that extends from Asia and elsewhere to, you know, the big box store nearest to you.
Yeah.
And all of those jobbers and middlemen and wholesalers and so on that used to support the entire economy is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if that larger globalized system starts to break down, but there's nothing there to pick up the pieces.
Right. We need to start recreating that, essentially.
That middle part of the economy that's so absent today is going to be key to making these stronger local communities function again the way they used to.
Yeah. Well, we have we have some callers that want to get in, so let's open up to the listeners. Our Willett studio phone is 456-9991. If you want to talk to Greg Paul, go ahead and call in. Hi there, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Greg Paul, thank you very much. And Jason, my name is Ike, and we do here have in Ukiah in Mendocino County a local a community-supported energy project. We do GALP, Greater Ukiah Localization Project, and we just started with the City Council of Ukiah. They voted at the last meeting to create a landfill gas task force to find out and explore the possibility of generating energy, either electricity energy or liquid natural gas energy. It depends. There is definitely different possibilities there. But this is a community-supported project. It went through the local people who have the interest to reduce the pollution in the neighborhood and to the atmosphere, and the greenhouse gas effect, what landfill gas is toxic. And there are already 395 different landfill gas to energy projects in the United States, and there are several in California. So I was wondering if you do any in Vermont, and if there is any local involvement in those energy projects regarding landfill gas.
Thank you, Ike.
Okay. Yes. There are, and this has been a an area of considerable interest and growth, actually, in recent years in New England. There are, I'm not sure exactly how many, but there are quite a few in the region, and one of the most recent was installed at the Coventry landfill, which is in northern Vermont, not too far from the Canadian border. And the Washington Electric Cooperative, which is a locally owned consumer cooperative, electric cooperative, is the primary investor in that project, and it produces a fairly substantial amount of the co-op's entire electrical production. So it's proven to be a very, very successful project here, and I will say that there is quite a bit of interest at the local level, again, across Vermont, in some smaller, more community-based projects like this. But the size of the landfill, you know, has to be large enough in order to make it really viable. So some of these communities are turning their attention to biogas facilities that would be more farm-based. So instead of relying on landfill gas, they would be relying on methane gas, basically, from the decomposition of farm waste, especially cow manure, which we have quite an abundance of here in our part of the country.
Yeah.
So there is a program called Cow Power, which is being run by Central Vermont Public Service, which is a publicly owned company that has signed up a number of farms to produce electricity from cow manure. And there are other projects like that that are in the planning stages, but there are quite a few smaller community-based projects that are at least being explored, although I'm not aware of any of them having actually been set up, except for, I think there's one that's using methane gas from a municipal sewage treatment plant for the generation of a small amount of electricity. And that's, I think, one of the first of its kind, at least in this area.
One of our Willis studios, 456-9991, if you want to call, talk to Greg Paul. One thing that was interesting to me is the what we call cow power. Yeah, those sort of projects. There's a lot of interest about that in California, other places. These huge, the dairy industry is so large, and there's also, you know, pig hog farms, et cetera.
Yep.
But what I find interesting is that to scale up this kind of you know, methane production requires this concentrated manure, and to get this concentrated manure requires this transportation network. That's pretty oil-based, so it's. I'm always wondering how sustainable these renewable energy projects are because of the scale of the agriculture involved. But we've got another caller, so let's let them get their question in. Hi there, you're on the air.
This is more of a comment. I was listening to KGO Money Talks the other day, and the interviewer had on a guest who was an expert in the economics of the fossil fuel industry, and the guy he was interviewing was expressing the emergency that's emerging, as they say. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about peak oil, and he was talking about where we're going with it all. But then the conversation got very cozy around nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they were doing, they were leading us right into that solution, clean, safe nuclear energy. They kept repeating it and repeating it. While the beginning of the conversation was about the emergency coming up.
Yeah.
One of the solutions is, you know, they talked about conservation, they talked about, becoming conscious and all this stuff, but then nuclear became the... That's all I wanted to say.
That's a good topic to talk about
here. They're pushing that one, mm-hmm. and recognizing that it's going to be 10 to 20 years out, even if they started now, and hopefully we can prevent that.
Yeah.
So anyhow.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Well, yeah, the math on this is pretty amazing. The there are 104 nuclear power plants, I think, in the U.S. right now, Greg, something like that. And California imports the equivalent of 120 nuclear power plants worth of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's any way we can actually fill any much of this gap at all with nuclear energy. Do you talk much about that in your book?
I do discuss nuclear energy in the earlier part of the book when I look at all of our options.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important for everybody to understand that nuclear energy is neither clean nor safe. There's going to be enormous political pressure to build more nuclear plants and to extend the licenses of existing plants beyond their original design. Lifespan, and because again the energy challenges that we are going to be facing here in the years ahead, it's going to be harder and harder to resist that pressure.
Yeah.
Because the argument basically is going to come down to: do you want to have the lights on, or do you want to have them off?
Right.
And if you want to have them on, then we're going to have to start getting really serious about where that energy is going to come from.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could make the argument, and a lot of people in the renewable energy sector are making the argument, that if we put the money that might be spent on nuclear into renewables, that we can make up the difference,
and conservation.
A lot of the difference in the renewables. But if we go and spend billions of dollars on more nukes, that's money that isn't going to be available for renewables. So there's going to be some real hard choices that we're going to have to make in the years ahead, about where we really want to put the emphasis, and I can guarantee you this is going to be a huge political battle.
Yeah, I issues come up around here about supply versus demand sort of issues, and one example locally is water, and
mm-hmm.
It's interesting. The average American home uses 3 times as much water as the average European home,
mm-hmm.
and yet we're told that we need to get a bit more water supply.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me just wonder, I've been to Europe a few times, and I don't see them suffering water shortages over there.
No, and they're not suffering from many other types of shortages either. They live perfectly comfortable and pleasant lives while consuming considerably less energy than we do. So it's quite possible to make substantial cuts in consumption and still live perfectly acceptable lives.
But it could take some investment. So, the billions of dollars that might go into a power plant, if they were invested, distributed in terms of conservation strategies within a home for energy, for water,
mm-hmm.
how would that compare? That's sort of I want to see that kind of math. We have another caller, though, so
okay.
Let's let them on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Brian from Willits. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Brian.
Mr. Paul, hi. So I was wondering if either of you would have any comments on the relationship between a community and possibly a municipally supported ag restructure with a landowners. Now, what's attractive to, say, someone who has 160 acres on the valley floor, you know, a significant amount of land that perhaps it's in cattle and hay? You know, are there some models for approaching landowners and including, you know, trying to get agricultural land back in production?
Okay.
So I'll sign off. Thanks for the program.
Thanks. Do you talk about sort of agriculture as an energy base and cooperative agriculture in your book, Greg?
The primary focus of the book is energy, mm-hmm. and I also understand that food and energy is interrelated. But the main focus really is on the energy side. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that there are agricultural components to energy as well, not the least of which is in biofuels mm-hmm. and biomass in general. And so in terms of biomass, there certainly is a lot of possibilities for local energy production. And at least here in northern New England, we are blessed with large amounts of biomass, especially forests, but also agricultural lands as well that are quite capable of producing oilseed crops for biofuels. And there's quite a bit of growing interest in, no pun intended, mm-hmm. in field crops like switchgrass or willows that can be planted by area farmers and then harvested as an energy crop for solid biofuels of one type or another, like wood pellets or grass pellets. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit of study going on right now about the economics of that, which is still the answer to that part of the question has still not been entirely answered, but I do know that there is quite a bit of solid biomass fuel activity going on in Europe, and they've already got the economics worked out over there.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can do it, I think we can do it as well, but it may require some new thinking.
Yeah, and so I think our caller was also really interested in the cooperative aspect of financing a project, say, maybe a food and energy project. I myself have an energy farm. It's called Brookside Farm. It's only an acre. We're trying to demonstrate some of these biofuel crops. We have a sunflower crop that's an oilseed sunflower.
Right.
We have a sorghum crop that's going to be pressed as a cane that could be converted to some ethanol. We're interested in some oilseed crops over the winter, like canola at some point. One of our challenges is figuring out how to do it sustainably because both environmentally and economically, the environmental problem is anytime you export biomass, you're also exporting nutrients. And we have a big problem also on the site of getting enough carbon to build compost piles that gives us the fertility without importing fertilizer. And so a lot of the biomass, of course, is carbon export.
Right.
So the question becomes, how can you, what really is possible for exporting from a land base and keeping it sustainable? And how do you then, if you do export, how do you recoup those nutrients on a local scale?
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the biophysical challenge. And then the economic challenge, of course, is that you can drill a well off of the coast of West Africa into deep water, pull it out, ship it across the ocean, and then across maybe the California refinery, and it'll come out at a gas tank, 150,000 BTUs at $3.50.
Right.
So yep. That's the reality right now, that the fossil fuels are phenomenally cheap. People
yes.
are complaining about it.
Yep.
But maybe let's get into what the caller wanted to talk about really was, how do people get together their financial resources? Maybe they're locked up in pensions and IRAs and say, okay, well, we want to try this local food and energy system. Any way that you can tap into the knowledge you have from community supported energy to think about it in terms of agriculture as well?
Well, I think the same general process
mm-hmm.
is the same for either type of project.
Yeah.
The primary thing is to identify the project as belonging to the community.
Okay.
And as offering a group community benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can demonstrate that, I think it becomes somewhat easier to get people to support it. But the key there is to demonstrate that community benefit. And I think another important thing for everybody listening to understand with these ideas is that they are relatively new concepts,
yeah,
at least for this country. And so we are working against the inertia of continuing to do things the way we've been doing them,
mm-hmm,
for the past, you know, several decades at least or more. And some of the biggest hurdles to get through in order to make these things work is, first of all, to get people to understand that they can do it.
Yeah.
That it is possible to do this. You don't have to continue to rely on outside resources or other people to do it for you. We can do this for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It has many benefits. But because we're talking about a new model, a new paradigm, the current system, and particularly the current regulatory and approval system and the current banking system, doesn't really support this sort of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so any group that wants to get involved in something like this has to understand, particularly early on here, that we are, in essence, pioneers,
yeah,
of a new model. And it's going to require more work in order to make it happen. But
mm-hmm,
there are literally thousands of examples of successful community-supported projects, energy projects, but also food projects, for that matter,
yeah,
from around the world,
yeah,
that clearly demonstrate that all this extra effort is worth it.
Well, let's end then with some suggestions for listeners of where would they go for more information. We don't have time to go into the details, but I know that there are probably resources, they're probably available online, maybe through groups like the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, or maybe the Schumacher Society. Do you have suggestions for how to go forward getting more information?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you mentioned one really excellent resource earlier on was the Post-Carbon Network.
Post-Carbon Institute.
Institute, yeah.
Yeah, Relocalization Network, relocalize.net.
Yep. I mean, that's a really good one.
Mm-hmm.
Good place to start. I think that there are probably any number of, through that network,
yeah,
you will locate local groups all over the country,
mm-hmm,
and literally all over the world,
yeah,
at this point, who are already engaged in some of this stuff.
Correct.
And so I think that's a really excellent resource.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose any publisher like Chelsea Green, which is one who publishes my books, has a really great catalog of many, many different titles that relate to sustainable living,
mm-hmm,
that are just invaluable resources for all types of projects like this. That'd mm-hmm be another great place to go.
Yeah, I know I'm going to a conference coming up called the Bali Conference. I think they were in Vermont last year.
Yes, they were, and it's a great group, and they've,
yeah,
got some wonderful programs and projects.
Yeah.
I highly recommend them.
So livingeconomies.org is their website.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have links at your website?
My website has links to the publisher primarily.
Okay.
Which is Chelsea Green.
Mm-hmm. They have a lot of books. So maybe postcarbon.org is a key one.
Mm-hmm.
Livingeconomies.org perhaps would be a good one for that.
Yep.
And I know that Intervale Farm, and there's one in Burlington, Vermont, that's,
yes,
kind of a community farm.
Yes.
So that's another great example.
Yeah. I guess one thing, final thing I'd like to say is that these,
mm-hmm,
these challenges may seem daunting, and they are,
mm-hmm,
but they also offer some enormous opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to see local communities all over the country start to take advantage of some of those opportunities.
Well, I really appreciate the time you've given us, and I certainly have enjoyed trying to create opportunities out of this. I'm not doing it because I'm quivering in fear of what's coming up.
Yep.
I'm doing it primarily because every day I get up excited about what I'm doing, and I can sense that in you as well.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks a lot, Greg, for being here, and you have a great week.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
All right. So our guest today, folks, on the Reality Report is Greg Paul. His most recent book was The Citizen-Powered Energy Handbook, Community Solutions to a Global Crisis. And thank you for our members and our underwriters today. Take care, everybody. Have a great week.